Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Friedberg Mercantile Group conference call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Albert Friedberg. Please go ahead, Mr. Friedberg.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a nice weekend. Jamie, do we have any questions this morning? Let's start right away.
Sure. Well, why don't we start off with just bringing us all up to speed with any changes that you've made to the portfolio over the past couple of weeks since we last spoke.
Okay. We actually made no substantive changes. No substantive changes. We actually just trimmed a little bit, moved out of a couple of positions that we had some leftover positions in Australia, moved out of those short positions. We're left with a very, very minor position in an ore producer. Increased a slight bit, very slight bit, our housing position, bringing it up to maybe 52% from 50% of assets. And increased the gold position by about 20%. Since then. So I, roughly speaking, that's what we've done. Again, may have been a couple of touches here and there, but the main positions remain exactly the same.
All right. So let's start off with some questions that were emailed to us in advance of the call. So in previous calls and letters, you've discussed your goal of structuring a portfolio that will benefit once either a known or unknown weakness in the economy or financial system leads to a crisis in capital markets. To that end, you've identified poorly capitalized and vulnerable banks in Europe, as well as taking positions in CDSs to profit from a sovereign default or restructuring. Given the perception of a forthcoming shift in the direction of monetary policy in the United States, you have switched most of your bond exposure to German bonds, as you told us in the last call. Could you tell us a little bit about what you see happening in Europe at the moment and how you expect it to affect the fund's positions? And also, have you placed much importance on the forthcoming German elections?
Okay. In truth, nothing really has changed in Europe. It's been a very quiet few months, no question about it. But nothing major has changed. The economies, the peripheral economies are looking like they have stopped contracting. Let's say the Eurozone looks like it has stopped contracting, mostly driven by a strong Germany. A few of the peripheral countries like Italy showed better numbers. No reform has been done, no significant reform has been carried out in any of the peripheral countries. We continue with the old austerity programs, which is passing through large tax increases, trying to do some cutbacks. And the most important thing of all, the debt burden continues to increase. Even with the Eurozone growing, assuming that it can grow at 0.5% to even 1% per annum in real terms, the debt load will continue to increase. So the debt to income will continue to increase. So we see nothing constructive happening there. We do have a decision coming out by the Constitutional Court in Germany about the reaches of the ECB, how far the ECB can go, how far Germany can allow the ECB to go. There's a whole number of decisions coming up. They are important. They will probably restrict a little bit further the scope of the ECB. The German election itself is not a question mark. It seems that Merkel is in, but there is a strong consciousness in Germany that they don't want to pay. They no longer want to pay any of the cost of this debt problem that Europe has. And so I think Merkel will probably have to go along with that. The Greek situation is a little bit worse than they expected, so there'll be another refinancing down there. Most likely it will come in the way of forgiveness of debt, and that will be now the second forgiveness of debt, and probably will not be sufficient. And I expect that sooner or later Portugal and Spain will ask for some debt forgiveness, and that will get the thing rolling. Again, I think that there's two possible scenarios. One of them is if it's done in an intelligent way and planned in advance, and then the impact will be, I won't say the impact will be minimal. The impact will be quite dramatic, but it at least will not have a devastating effect on the world economy. Or it could be done in a chaotic way, and that could have a devastating effect. And, of course, it could be done inside of the European zone or outside the European zone, and the combination of permutations are fairly large. But of this, we are convinced, 100% convinced, that the moment is coming for a lot of these peripheral countries to begin a long-awaited restructuring. We are positioned to take advantage of that. We own a fairly large position in credit default swaps. And what that means is that we bet against the integrity of the debt of these countries, so that if they restructure or default, we make a very large gain on that short position, let's say, of it's almost like being short bonds. We make a substantial profit in that. We are short also a few large European banks, in particular two Spanish banks, Santander and BBVA. We also short some Deutsche Bank. So generally, we are well situated if and when such an event occurs. It is expensive to carry these positions, although much less expensive now. In other words, we have taken already a fairly large hit on carrying these, and at this time the cost is it's quite reasonable. Actually, on a risk-reward basis, it makes a lot of sense today to buy more protection. And I believe that answered the question, right?
Okay. A major theme we've seen since the Fed started discussing tapering back in April is rising yields in the United States. And that's had quite a large impact in emerging markets, triggering large outflows from their own stock and fixed income markets, which has also had a negative effect on their currencies. How is the fund positioned in relation to this theme? And on the subject of emerging markets, how much importance do you place on the perceived weakness in China?
Okay, first it's important to understand that the Fed action, what's called a QE, operated in a way that it's not the way we all had thought it would operate, which is by increasing reserves, increasing the monetary base, it would increase money supply, and it would then we would see a large increase in money supply, which would have an impact, a strong impact on nominal income and inflation. It hasn't happened that way, and we've discussed it a number of times already. So far, we have seen a very moderate increase in money. So far, it seems that QE has been ineffective in accelerating the growth of money. So, but what did happen is that it gave the impression, it's a psychological maybe, and maybe some of it is more than psychological, and that the Fed is buying bonds. So when they buy bonds, they are maintaining or they're holding rates at a certain level. And psychologically, it gave the impression that the Fed was strongly interested in low rates, and this caused the investing public in the U.S. and in Europe and in many other parts to look for alternatives to low interest rates. And a lot of the money went to emerging countries, where they were able to get better rates, better returns, and it became a flood. And so we had huge amounts of money going to places like India and Brazil and Indonesia and Thailand and Philippines and so on. And these flows were unfortunate in some sense because they papered over a lot of the problems these countries had and made them feel comfortable, made them feel that they didn't have to make any changes, they don't have to implement any reforms. And the flood of money, of course, raised their asset prices. And so now we're finding that when the Fed is saying, well, we're going to start tapering, we're going to start withdrawing some of the stimulus, even though the stimulus was not a stimulus in the sense that we thought it would be, but it was more psychological and partly, my guess is mostly psychological. We find now that the investing public is starting to say, well, if that's the case, we should get out of the emerging markets because we can get probably better returns, and we are getting better returns in North America, where bond yields have gone up 100 or 120 basis points. So a lot of it is psychological, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that these countries did not undertake, as I said before, the proper reforms. Spending reforms and even at the micro level, they have not undertaken the proper reforms. So we are beginning to see withdrawals of money from these countries in fairly large amounts, and it could become very large because the amount of money that went in there is huge. And the countries that have not done enough to prepare themselves for the moment, for that moment, will suffer greatly. So we're already seeing India under a lot of pressure, Indonesia under a lot of pressure, and Brazil under a lot of pressure. We have a particularly strong position in Brazil and India, and continue to maintain it. On the short side, and other emerging markets are suffering too, and we have a general play on those via other emerging market ETFs and so on. So now how much of it is based on China? And it's not really based on China. None of these things are based on China. China is a separate case, and the bearish case in China is not necessarily a cyclical or a momentary play, but it is based on the fact that China has grown by a central directive in a way, increasing debt in very large increases in debt, and done from a central committee without understanding well the local economics, and so they have burdened the country with a huge debt, private and public. And it is retarding their growth, and it's more of a secular type of a trend. We think that China is moving slowly towards lower and lower rates of growth. So we're probably going to be moving to 6 and then 5 and then 4 and then 3% and so on. And that can create also a lot of stress, a lot of social stress and problems in that country. So China has its own problems, and it will have its own effect on neighbors in terms of trade and on commodity prices. Will slow the pace of commodity purchases around the world, so that it will have a bearish impact on many of the items that they buy. And that's a separate way. That's a separate impact in the portfolio. We have not entered the Chinese market in a big way because it is hard to do that. It is hard to find the right stocks. It is hard to put on positions. It's a closed market, so you have to do it via Hong Kong. We've done a little bit of via Hong Kong and done some special deals to try to be short in some way China. But really, the main impact of China is a global impact. And from that point of view, we are participating in that, for example, being short oil, which we think that is majorly impacted by China.
Okay. At this point, I just want to invite all of our callers to queue in to ask their own questions. Valerie, would you please remind us how we do that?
Certainly. For telephone participants, please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register for questions. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Albert, you know, in previous calls, you've discussed a short position in Japanese government bonds, and more recently, you've put on a small short position in the Japanese stock market. Would you please discuss what's behind those trades and what your thoughts are on Abenomics and the proposed reforms that might be coming down the pipeline?
Well, the so-called reforms are still not there, and we're waiting for them. There's a lot of things that Japan needs to do. And besides reform, we have this big package of taxes coming up, which now they're not sure whether they're going to do it or not. I'm myself not sure whether it's a good thing for Japan, huge increases in the sales tax. All we've seen so far is a lot of noise. We had the Bank of Japan buying very large quantities of securities, doing another QE. Interestingly, even in Japan, it has not spilled over into money supply, but it's more psychological. So you have had a lot of buying associated with a lot of buying in asset markets, including, by the way, real estate markets. And we have managed to, at least temporarily, move the CPI from negative to positive. And, of course, a positive CPI, if it does get to the 2% on a sustained basis, it should be quite bearish for the Japanese JGBs, for their bonds, which are only yielding 0.7%. I think that, for the most part, that the big rise has taken place already when it comes to securities markets, stocks, for example. And unless we see some substantial move in reform, which is lacking in Japan, we are going to see the market sell off slowly over time.
Right. Looking at what's moved the portfolio over the past couple months, we see that home builders were certainly the largest contributor to our negative performance. Would you please tell us about what you've done, if anything, to protect this position and what the effect of rising yields would have on your home builder portfolio should the current trend continue?
Right. So far and away, the single largest adverse move that we've had in the portfolio is the home builders, the single largest. And I should say that we remain extremely friendly to that sector, and I'll explain why in a minute. But it's not that we want to protect it. We don't want to protect that position. We think that that is still the best long position that we can have in the U.S. market today because it has the right fundamentals going for it. So there is no protection to that housing market. What there is is a short position in, for example, emerging markets. And if the global economy shrinks, I think that the emerging markets, as an example, will go down probably faster than housing in the U.S. And if the U.S. does better than the foreign markets, which we think it will, and we think that the home builders will do well. So it's not that we're trying to protect that position. We think we are happy with that position. We think that around 50% exposure to capital is right. It's an aggressive position, I admit, a very aggressive position, but it is manageable. The fundamentals are great. We have a shortage of housing that's developed for the past 4 or 5 years because of very little construction. Prices are rising. It allows builders to be comfortable with their inventory and to make money and on margins. And this is a situation that will last for a long time until we get to see starts much, much higher. This is going to be the case for a number of years. At the same time, mortgage rates are going up, but assuming that mortgage rates, and I can discuss it at a different moment, but assuming that mortgage rates go up even to 5%, I've already mentioned the fact that in the housing sector, for housing, those are negative interest rates because housing prices are going up at least 1% a month, 12% a year. So anybody thinking about borrowing money and paying 4.5% or 4.75% or 5% or 5.25% will find himself making a nice profit buying houses today. The fundamentals are really aligned properly for them to do well. I'm not concerned about mortgage rates. And now I'll say one quick word about mortgages. The Federal Reserve and its QE, it has split the QE in two parts, mortgage bonds, mortgage-backed securities, and treasuries. When they taper, and it's likely that they will begin in September, and hopefully they do, and hopefully they give a timetable so that they can say in September that they will taper in September, and again in December, and again in March, and so we have more visibility, which is what the market needs. Chances are that they will do it by way of cutting back on the Treasury side. Given that they're very conscious of the role of housing in the economy, they will want to help the housing market as much as they can, and therefore the tapering, in my view, will come by reducing Treasury purchases. That will give some support to the mortgage market, and that will probably support the spreads, and we should see actually mortgage to Treasury spreads narrow, and that's bullish again for housing. And that may be the psychological catalyst for the market to turn around. I'm not sure yet where the catalyst is after this long, drawn-out 2-3 months decline. But I believe that could be one of the catalysts. First, visibility. Second, the fact that spreads would narrow if the Fed moves from buying both mortgage-backed securities and treasuries to selling, but selling only treasuries and leaving the mortgage-backed securities to run off.
All right. Thank you. You mentioned earlier in the call that over the past couple of weeks you've increased your position in gold. Can you tell us what prompted you re-entering this market after exiting it only a few months ago?
Yeah, well, that was one of those cases, I guess, one of those cases that happens to all of us all the time, or most of the time, or some of the time, hopefully only some of the time. Some whipsaw, you know, we get some whipsaw, and we liquidated a position in the global macro fund, not in the asset allocation, which is not leveraged, but in the global macro because of the leverage and the danger to the overall position and the way it was moving with and along some of the other markets. So we did, and then we reentered. But the main thing, the main point was that I explained this a number of times in the past, was that we wanted to see confirmation that gold was outperforming equities before we jump back in. And we started getting that confirmation about 4 or 5 weeks ago, maybe a little longer, I don't now recall. And it's been actually, except for the last day or two, it's been actually moving in that direction. Gold has done very well versus equities. And I believe that now the moment has come where we're going to see a better a much better gold market, as if investment sentiment has started to move in that direction. So we're very happy with the gold position. It's at the moment roughly 50% of our assets, and we may yet increase a little bit further, but we are very satisfied with where it is now.
All right, and while we're on the subject of commodities, you've had a very long-term short position in crude oil. And given the increasing tensions in the Middle East surrounding Syria, are you at all concerned about a short-term, quick run-up in crude prices hurting the fund?
Yeah, I think that's a concern, and that's actually been the case in the oil market now for a number of years. There is a premium in the market that's attributable to Middle East worries. And analysts have talked about a premium of $10 to maybe $20 or $30 a barrel. That's what the premium is for, that premium, that concern that maybe supplies will be cut off. Right now, the position that we have is long, very nearby oil, and actually not a U.S. oil, but more like an international oil, like Brent, in case anything happens short-term, like a cut-off of supplies. But we are short the back months of oil, the long-term back months of oil, and we believe that they will continue to come under pressure from producers who are hedging their output, and so I think we can benefit actually from both events, an increase in the near term of the price because of a flare up, because of a crisis, and a slow and steady descent in the back months. And actually, it's been happening. We are making a little bit of money in that position even during this crisis.
Okay. We still don't have anyone queuing up for questions, so I'd like to encourage everyone to press *1 if they'd like to ask a question. Otherwise, we'll have one final question. During a conference call several years ago, you stated that if a general viewpoint or strategy isn't working after 6 months, you're forced to reassess both. Given that the current strategy has produced a very large drawdown over a period longer than 6 months, why have you not altered the strategy?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm not going to say that we did not alter it. We didn't alter the spirit of it. We have made significant changes, trading changes, in the past few months, in the past 2 months. We've made significant changes. We have tightened up the position quite a bit. And even though we don't like to trade or overtrade because that's costly to the portfolio, we find that in difficult times and times of drawdown, you're always best off doing some overtrading. You shouldn't be overtrading when things are going well. So if I look back over the past 2 months, I would say that we have made some significant focused the position significantly, and gotten rid of a lot of positions that were possibly good, or that would be possibly that we could think that they would do well in the next while, but we thought that the time horizon would be too far removed. We have reduced those. We have eliminated those. We have remained with basically what are positions that can do well over the next 6 months, and kept some of these insurance positions, like we said before, credit default swaps, which are things that can happen suddenly and there's no way to time it, and also where the cost at the moment is reasonable. So that question is always in the back of my mind. If it's not working, let us try to work it. And if the further adjustments don't work and the main substantive themes don't work, and I think that they are, at the moment as I see them for the past few weeks, they are beginning to work. But if that theme doesn't work, you can be sure that we will be changing.
All right. Well, with that, I'd like to thank you once again for taking the time to speak with us today, and thank everyone who found the time to call in and participate with this call, and everyone that sent in their questions in advance. I think that that wraps it up for today.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right, have a good day.
Cheers.
Thank you, gentlemen. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.